You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the current impeachment inquiry is causing a lot of people to think back to the only other times we've seen something like this in American history. We'll talk to a historian who says that may not be as helpful as we think. Now, you might know Professor Mike Leckrone as the longtime director of the UW Marching Band. He retired from that position recently after 50 years at the helm, but he's still sharing his love of music. He's teaching a course about the big band era through the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. It starts next week. You can find info on how to register at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. Mike Leckrone joins us in the studio now. Mike, thanks so much for coming up.
Oh, Rob, I'm pleased to be here. Really am.
Well, take us to the big band era. What is the time period we're really talking about with the heyday of the big bands?
Well, the real heyday occurred in the 30s. Remember, everybody thinks of the 30s as the big band era, but because that's in 1935. That's when Benny Goodman got started and the Carnegie Hall concert came shortly later. But it really started really before that. I mean, you go back to the time of Duke Ellington, Paul Whiteman. That was in the 20s, and that's where bands started being almost, you'd say, a headliner in theaters, on stage, everywhere they could go. So it goes back really into the beginning of the 30s, and it lasted until about 1945. And then after the war, singers started to take over all of the pop music charts at that time.
And it seems our two jobs kind of lined up there. The real heyday, the rise of the big bands, came along with the rise of radio. How important was them coming in at the same time?
Well, radio was very important because in the earliest days, a performer had to appear on the radio to get any notice at all, because there wasn't the recording industry that we have now. And then when recordings came in after radio, then radio became even more important so far as the bands were concerned, because that's where all the discs, that's where all the recordings got out. The disc jockeys started to take over and do a lot. So the radio and the era of the big bands really coincided almost exactly at the same time.
Before we start listening to some music, I want to talk about the range of music, because it seems like you've got stuff that was almost like the punk rock, like a lot of improvisation to really heavily orchestrated stuff, swingy dance tunes to slow dance tunes. We're talking about a lot of different types of music, right?
Right. When people ask me what was a big band, I usually use three or four criteria. First of all, they had to have more than seven people.
had to be big.
Yeah, it had to be big. And some people say, well, seven isn't very big, but you have to have enough people that you can have sections. You can't just have solo instruments playing, because then it's kind of like a jazz combo at that point. But if you've got more than seven people, you almost by necessity have to have sections. And then they have to play written arrangements or things that are heavily arranged so that it sounds the same every time. A lot of people use what they call head arrangements at that time. And then the third element is dancing. You've got to be able to dance to this early music, and that's where it really got most of its impetus at that point.
We are talking about the music of the big band era. Mike Leckrone is with us, longtime band director at UW-Madison. He's teaching a course on the topic now. Well, let's hear some music, and I want to start with a name you mentioned, Duke Ellington and his orchestra. Don't Mean a Thing.
Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
It don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is swing.
I think you've got a whole section of the class just on Duke Ellington. You could probably do a whole class Ellington.
You could do a year on Duke Ellington, yeah, because he was such an important figure in American music. I think some people say Duke Ellington was American music at one point. That's a quote that is often used. But he started so many things, and he started in an era where it was just coming, jazz was just coming out of the districts where people didn't really like to consider it nice music. It was music that was, you know, played in all sorts of areas, the bars and so forth, and said it had a bad reputation. But Ellington started to make a little bit more of a, I guess you'd say, a concert appearance. It became not just music for the bars, not just music for dances and so forth. It became highly personalized music. And I think when you listen to Ellington, everything that he did had that flavor of Duke Ellington. You couldn't miss his band for anybody.
And I want to give a listen to Paul Whiteman, a song called Happy Feet, before we talk about Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. I think you've got another section in your class
on him too,
this is a whirlwind tour here. We only have a little bit of time. Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. understand there was some controversy over Paul Whiteman declaring himself the king of jazz.
Well, yeah, and Whiteman was also always very clear to point out he didn't give himself that connotation.
Okay. That was given to him.
It was given to him by some of his fans and some of his promoters, but he accepted it. I think he didn't turn his back on it. But he was, the king of jazz. A lot of people said, well, what he play isn't jazz. But there again, we get into whether that's a definition that you want to follow or I want to follow, because jazz has just so many different areas. And this is music was highly arranged, very carefully arranged. And so there wasn't a lot of room for the soloist to get up. And I think there's a feeling for a lot of people when you hear jazz, you're hearing improvised solos. But with Whiteman, you didn't get too much of the improvisation. I think an argument for the Whiteman band as being a jazz band is the guys who wrote the arrangements were highly trained jazz musicians, and so they wrote things in that flavor of the time. So it was music that had was one time removed from actually being performed extemporaneously.
Well, this is the kind of argument you could have with any type of music. It's like, is it jazz for decades? Yeah. Is this really rock? Is this really classical music? A lot of the arguments we have over any kind of music, they happen with the big band era too.
Well, yeah, and the big band era, one of the things that I find very interesting about it is the only time, I think, in American popular music that jazz was the popular idiom. When you get to a little later periods, jazz loses some of its popularity to rock and roll. And the fact is, there was a short period of time where it was country western would probably be considered the American music. But with jazz, it had that short period of time from, say, 35 to 45, where it was what everybody thought of as American popular music.
Oh, and it made it into the movies, too. We've got a clip of Cab Calloway here in the movie Stormy Weather, 1943, I think. Here's a listen. So this is the pinnacle of not just music culture, but pop culture in a lot of ways, too.
Right. And you know, Cab Calloway sometimes overlooked because he was such a pop figure. I mean, he was this jive guy that got on the radio and talked jive talk, and he was really a character. And so a lot of what he did musically was lost because he was considered more almost a caricature of what a jazz musician should have been at the time. But he was really quite good, and if you listen to some of his vocals, they have the same kind of spontaneous contemporary jazz that you would expect at the time.
That's interesting. I've heard the same argument made over a Louis Armstrong. He was such a character, and people focused on the character, and I think it was when the commemorative stamp came out, music people were really glad they showed him actually playing the trumpet.
Right.
They showed him as a musician, not just as a celebrity.
Right. He had become a pop figure because of some of times it's just his singing, because he was singing pop songs that had made it to the hit parade. I mean, he had a big tune on Hello Dolly back in the 60s, and people looked at him as that kind of a figure as opposed to what he was, which is a giant in the area of jazz.
I want to bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm calling to tell you that my father arranged music for Paul Whiteman. My father was sent to a seminary in Cincinnati when he was 9 years old. His mother proclaimed that he should be a priest. So he stayed at the seminary for many, many years, but never took any vows, got out, started a band because he had received a wonderful music education at this seminary, started a band, and eventually got in contact with Paul Whiteman and started arranging his music. My father's name was Leon Matthew, and I'm sure that your guest probably has seen his name on old sheet music.
I have seen the name, yeah.
Nancy, thank you so much. Wow, what a story. I guess he did find his calling after all. Can you talk about, that reminds me, the role of the composer and arranger, because Duke Ellington had, Billy Strayhorn writing music with him.
Billy Strayhorn wrote a lot of things. He was sort of what we might more... scholastically call an amanuensis, because he would sometimes Ellington would even call him on the phone and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and uh-huh. Strayhorn would write it down. Duke had his own talent, and he was very careful to most of the time, and I'll put that most of the time, credit all those people. I mean, if you see a tune that Billy Strayhorn wrote, Take the A Train, right. for example, that's credited solely to Billy Strayhorn, who probably Ellington did some of the work on it, but I think it was at a time when Ellington was feeling very generous and felt like, well, some of these royalties should go to Strayhorn, who was so helpful in what he did.
Thanks a lot for that call and that yes. story. Appreciate it. We're talking to Mike Leckrone. He's with us to talk about a continuing education class he's teaching about the big band era. You might also know him as the longtime director of the UW Bands and the UW Marching Band. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the big band era, whether you grew up with it or just discovered it in your youth in this era? Who are your favorite performers, favorite songs? Call 800-642-1234. Or, hey, there are still big bands out there. Are you in one of them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the big band era with Mike Leckrone. The former UW Marching Band director is teaching a class at the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. It starts next week. You can find info on how to register at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. You can call in now, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Mike about big bands and the big band era, or do you want to share your own favorite performer, song, singer, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, we came in with Woody Herman there, a big Wisconsin connection
Wisconsin,
on that one.
Wisconsin kid, born in Milwaukee, and did most of his formative years in that Milwaukee area playing, and he was billed often as the boy wonder of the clarinet, but he also tap danced, he sang, and this was as a kid when he was in junior high school and high school, and so he has great Wisconsin connection, and then became one of the biggest names in the big band era.
Was Wisconsin a hot place for big bands, or were we just kind of a stopover?
No, I think Milwaukee. If you look at the history of Milwaukee, you'll see that a lot of the big bands made their home there. Plus, this was a great place. You say it a stopping place, but it was also a very important opportunity for people to play if they were going to Chicago or coming out of Chicago. So by its very nature, Wisconsin has a huge history in the development of big bands, and their former dance halls all over the state that can claim that so-and-so performed here in Madison in McFarland, the Park Ponderosa for many years was up into the 80s and 90s. It was a pretty hotbed for bands that were touring still and playing.
I wanted to bring up a race. This is a segregated era through most of the United States. Some bands were segregated. Occasionally, some weren't. Can you talk about how that all went?
Well, most of the bands at this point were segregated. When they did break the color line, as I used to say, it was often big news. The one who probably did it the most dramatically was Benny Goodman when he broke the color line with his Teddy Wilson and some of the other people that Lionel Hampton, and that broke that immediately. You saw white musicians and black musicians playing together on stage, and that was a very, very important step. The interesting thing is it didn't cause much consternation. The audiences at that point were so engrossed with the big band period that they just accepted the fact that these musicians were going to learn to play together, and it came off without too much of a difficulty. There were other instances. You mentioned Count Basie, and Count Basie at different times would hire singers that didn't look black enough, as they would say. They would have to make them up so that they would look more fitting into the part. And even Duke Ellington, there was a man named Juan Tizel who was Cuban, and they had to make Juan Tizel up to look darker when he would appear on stage. So that was the kind of times that we were going through. Gradually, that the musicians felt that they broke down a lot of those color lines so that they disappeared. And you mentioned earlier Duke Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong toured for many years with Jack Teagarden, who was a white musician, and they played on stage many, many times and without any concern at all about it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Larry is with us in New Berlin. Larry, hi.
Hi. Great talk. You asked if people, you know, if they liked the big band era, or if they... I always had trouble with it. It always seemed like a smoothing over of jazz. But the thing that really irritated me was the sense of the big band director, that one of the things about jazz was always this really free individuality, and you couldn't tell what was going to happen at any moment. And that gave way, kind of like in this, at the turn of the 1800s, the big orchestras came about and killed the groups of soloists.
Interesting, Larry. Thanks a lot for the call. So Larry's worried that you lost some of the individuality and some of the spontaneity when you took that small jazz act and turned it into a 17-piece band or whatever.
Well, I think that's a good argument, but I think the argument that would be in favor of the big bands would say that what you did is you substituted the arrangers who put that spontaneity, who put that improvisation, you'd say, into the music. They would write it out so that you were hearing a sense of improvisation. I heard many jazz performers play things that I didn't think were terribly improvised, that you knew they had picked up it by playing the solo over and over. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened with the big bands. They wrote out a lot of this improvisation. If you listen to a lot of Duke Ellington, you'll notice he might play a tune like Black and Tan Fantasy. He might have recorded it, well, I think he recorded it probably 12 or 15 times. But it's different many of the times, and that shows you the creativity that they brought to that thing. And some of the bands got stuck in a rut and played the same arrangements the same way every time. But the big bands opened up, as the terminology would have been it today, and they would say, okay, Harry James, you play a solo in this 32 bars, or Benny Goodman, you play your solo. And it would be totally improvised for that period of time.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David in Elkhorn. David, hi.
Hi. I saw Duke Ellington at the Summerfest in the very early years at Miller Jazz Oasis. My girlfriend and I somehow ended up sitting on stage with a back against the PA system right about 8 feet from Duke Ellington. And nobody could see us from the audience. And Duke Ellington would play, and he'd be winking at her. And each time a soloist came out and got to the front to do a solo, they'd walk down across the stage, and they'd play right directly to her, looking her right in the eye. And nobody could see that from the audience. And
that's the story. David, you got to share a stage with Duke Ellington. Not many musicians can say that. had a story about Duke Ellington spending a week on the campus at UW-Madison.
This is about 1970, the university saw fit to bring Duke Ellington and his entire band to the campus for a week. And they played in every facility on campus that they could have. They played at the Union. They played at the stadium. They played in the field house. They played everywhere you could imagine. And it was just a wonderful experience. Plus, Duke and his band did daily clinics in the humanities building. And so that you got a chance to be right next to Duke Ellington as he was talking about the music. It was just a phenomenal experience, and it was there for a week. And as I think any of us that were there will never forget it.
Thanks a lot for calling and sharing that story. Back to your calls as we talk to Mike Lecrone about the big band era. He's teaching a class on it. Roger joins us from Milwaukee. Roger, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question, or two of my questions are, is how did some of these band members and band leaders get their nicknames, like Cozy Cole, Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, Count Basie, and are there any famous Wisconsin people besides Woody Herman who have nicknames for band leaders?
Roger, thanks. So first of all, we got a lot of nobility, the Counts and the Dukes out there.
Well, most people say that Duke Ellington started it, and he got that title mostly because he was such a dignified individual, and his real name is Edward Ellington, but Edward Kennedy Ellington, and people felt like this was a guy when he was on stage or when he was performing piano many times. He was a very elegant person, and so people started calling him Duke, and then it sort of crept out into other areas. Count Basie said that there's a Duke, and then there was a there ought to be a Count, and so it spread to a lot. The title thing got spread out to a lot of different people, and you know, Woody Herman, his obviously his real name is Woodrow, so that was
an easy one.
That was an easy one for them. And there were a lot of he mentioned Cozy Cole. Now, I don't know where that name came from, but my guess is that there's a lot of the names were playoffs on the person's original name. And I don't remember even what Cozy Cole's original name was, but it could have been something like Cosmo or something. Don't quote me on that one, but that's the way the names usually got. I mean, or sometimes they were Pee Wee Hunt was a famous band leader. Pee Wee Hunt was not very small. So it was kind of sometimes a lot of the band leaders got the name based on what they weren't as opposed to what they were.
And he had asked, any other names you want to drop apart from Woodrow Herman here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, it's been mentioned a couple of times, but there was a great trumpet player named Bunny Berrigan,
sure,
who was out of Fox Lake, Wisconsin. Bunny, again, his real name was Bernard, so it was kind of an easy transition to Bunny, but he was one of the great trumpet players of the era, and he was from Fox Lake and spent a lot of early years right here in Madison, playing at various venues around town.
Let's give a quick listen. Count Basie, you just mentioned, and Billie Holiday here, Swing Brothers Swing.
Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me.
So talk about the role of the singers here in just our last few moments.
Well, the singers were sort of late comers in a way. They were almost incidental to the big bands. In the earliest days, Paul Whiteman had singers, one of whom was Bing Crosby, who later on...
he did okay.
Yeah, he took off on his own, but most of the time it was the singers came in, they did their chorus or a half chorus, and then they sat down, and that was the end of it. But then they started developing a personality. A lot of that happened during the Second World War when the manpower was hard to get, but some of the singers, Frank Sinatra, many people feel owe his fame to the fact that he was 4F, not eligible for the service, and so he got great popularity during that time during the war when a lot of the other people were being drafted and not being able to perform.
Well, Mike, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
It went fast.
That's Mike Lecroe, and he was with us to talk about the big band era. The former UW Marching Band director is teaching a class on that topic at UW-Madison's Division of Continuing Studies. Find info at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time.